Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Stock Club is brought to you by Hyundai. Restart your journey towards a greener world with Hyundai's next generation of zero-emission cars. Find out more about their range of electric vehicles and the savings they can bring to your company and employees at Hyundai.ie. Hi there, welcome to the Stock Club podcast. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage, and our head analyst, Rory Caron. In this episode, we're talking about the incredible fraud accusations against Nikola and its rolling trucks, Apple's new Peloton killer, and the reason why traditional valuation metrics just don't work in the modern market. So guys, every so often in this podcast, we come across a story that's just so wild that we can't wait to talk about it. And I'm really glad to say we have one of these stories for you today. We're talking about a company that's focused specifically on the EV market, but incredibly, we're actually not talking about Elon Musk. We're talking about Nikola Motors. So Nikola Motors is a name that's become huge in the EV world over the past year, with its stock actually jumping more than sixfold in the first half of this year alone. A recent announcement of a deal with General Motors, which would see the iconic car manufacturer take an 11% stake in the company, was warmly received by the market as well. And it really looked like Nikola was becoming a real contender in the future for EV vehicles, even though it has yet to sell a single car. However, a report by the short-selling firm Hindenburg Research last week has claimed that Nikola has been involved in a myriad of fraudulent activities, including questions over the qualifications of its director of hydrogen production and infrastructure, and, most amazingly, a claim that a video posted last year by the company showcasing its Nikola One truck in motion was actually a setup, with the truck being pushed down a hill instead of being powered by its own engine. Rory, I'm going to come to you first on this because we've been pretty much laughing about this story for the past week. What the hell is going on at Nikola?
This is our WeWork story of the year, isn't it?
Yeah.
we'll get a lot of mileage out of this, unlike Nikola's trucks. Yeah, can I also just one more before I start? I love that it was Hindenburg Research that broke this story on a hydrogen fuel cell company. That's just too perfect.
It's really just the universe conspiring for the perfect story.
Yeah, so as you said, Hindenburg Research published a short report just days after they'd announced this big deal with General Motors, which basically laid out a series of fraudulent behaviors that the company had undertaken over the last couple of years. You already mentioned the video. Yeah, like anyone who watches that video, would be absolutely certain that that truck is being shown to drive along a highway and that it works, that it's a fully functioning truck. But as we found out, that was not the case. They brought it to a hilly section of the highway somewhere in America, put it up at the top and basically let it roll down the slope and filmed it so it looked like it was moving under its own power.
Yeah, and I should probably just here mention that Nikola came back with a rebuttal against, you know, Hindenburg's claims and said, and I quote, "We never stated the truck was driving under its own propulsion in the video, although the truck was designed just to do that."
Like, okay, well, I'll bang back with another quote, which is from the CEO, and this is from, I believe, back in 2016 at the launch event. In quotes, "This thing fully functions and works, which is really incredible." We have since, well, Hindenburg have alleged, and they've published text message exchanges, which seem to show this, that the truck wasn't functioning at all at that point, and that they never actually got it fully functioning at all. Instead, they moved into the pickup truck side of the business, and once they had the money, they realized that they didn't really need to go back to working on the Nikola One, so that it wasn't, they didn't want to, essentially didn't want to waste resources on it. Now, like, I can't imagine how anyone would invest in this business after if these claims are true, and it does appear like they are true. I wasn't particularly au fait with the whole GM deal to begin with, because neither Nikola nor GM were companies that we were following closely. But since I've looked into it, I mean, there is some really interesting takes from people who do seem to know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
First of all, this deal with GM was absolutely terrible for Nikola. Like, it was, no one could understand why they'd done this, because this is supposed to be a company that has hydrogen fuel cell technology that's light years ahead of everyone else. And the deal was just lousy for them. You know, they were basically paying GM to build a car with their badge on it. They weren't using the hydrogen cell technology that Nikola had produced themselves. It was all being built on the GM platform, and GM were basically getting a massive parts deal out of it, because all the drivetrains and components were going to be GM components. So
yeah,
this definitely appears to have been a deal that was structured almost entirely to make Nikola come across as a plausible automobile company.
We can't get away from it rolling down the hill. We just can't. I mean, I was chatting with my friend Donal, who loves trucks, about the whole Tired affair, and his summation was that Nikola is basically a skateboard in the shape of a truck. And we were wondering if one of their vehicles will qualify for the Red Bull Soapbox race, which is fairly well known in this part of the world, where according to the official rules, and I quote, the vehicle must have steering and braking capability. Teams are judged on both the time taken to complete the course as well as creativity of their design and the showmanship of performance at the start of the race. Now, Nikola definitely has the showmanship nailed, especially when they bring General Motors into the frame.
I don't even know if we can confirm if the truck has braking ability. Like, it didn't show it stopping in the video. It could still be rolling down a hill out there in the desert.
Yeah, and look, what's interesting about this is, you know, it says an awful lot about the nature of innovation, or at least the nature of innovation as we have it today. And I'm reading Morgan Housel's excellent new book. I think you are as well, Emmett. Yeah. And there's a chapter in there about risk versus luck, you know, and he's talking about Charles Vanderbilt, who built an entire railroad network, but he did it all by breaking pretty much every state law out there. Now, looking back on that and using resulting, we would go, what a cheeky devil. Well done to him for getting away with it. But no one today would suggest a business owner break laws in order to build a business, because you're going to end up in jail. Like, that's the risk reward payout doesn't seem appropriate there. And I was reading back through, this made me think of Bad Blood and the whole Theranos scandal. And, you know, what was really interesting about that book was that John Carreyrou at the end does seem to find some sort of kind of sympathy with Elizabeth Holmes. I pulled out a quick quote. He says at the end, by all accounts, she had a vision that she genuinely believed in and threw herself into realizing. But in her all-consuming quest to be the second coming of Steve Jobs, amid the gold rush of the unicorn boom, there came a point when she stopped listening to sound advice and began to cut corners. Her ambition was voracious and it brooked no interference. If there was collateral damage on her way to riches and fame, so be it. And that seems to be like an awful lot of what's happening in Silicon Valley right now. You really fake it till you make it. You know, the line between visionary and fraudster is very thin. And it's usually the person who just lies enough until they get something working that survives this whole mess. So Nikola, incredible story. I'm sure there'll be more. We've no idea what's going on with the SEC. I see the founder bought $1.4 million worth of shares there the other day to try and pump up the stock price. I mean, his net worth is way over $3 or $4 billion. So it's not much of a signal there. But this will definitely be one of the stories of the year, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And the fact that, you know, the news is kind of broken by Hindenburg Research, which are a short selling firm, I believe, that kind of brought up another question for me. And Emmett, I might throw this over to you, is with these kind of short seller reports like this, how careful do we have to be if, you know, the company has a financial benefit in the stock price of the company it's talking about depreciating? Where do we draw the line between, you know, this being, you know, a revelation, you know, facts, news, and this being a financial incentive for a short seller?
Well, we have to keep in the back of our mind that short seller reports are written to serve their purpose. Now, really, what the variable is, how factual are these reports? So when you see a short seller's report on a business that you've taken an interest in and feel optimistic about based on what you've read on their strategy, their mission, their addressable market, their barriers to entry, and you basically put your money down on the table, along comes a giant institution, has a bench of researchers who very possibly from the outset have decided they want to short this business and go seeking facts to support that that report. So yeah, I used to take them with an absolute pinch of salt and give them no credence whatsoever. I now read short seller reports in, like, I suppose, an acknowledgement that it might be correct, but I don't, it doesn't change my course or my decision or my action. It informs my thinking, and occasionally, as we've seen in the not too far past, they're right, and you just get on with it.
It reminded me of Citroen Research, who I think have issued about 3 or 4 short selling reports on Shopify. It's not really working out for them at the moment.
No.
I take Emmett's point there, but I mean, you've got to remember as well, you know, if I own a stock and I publish a stock of the month report in it, I have a financial incentive in it appreciating in value.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I agree with you. There are bad actors out there, but I think short sellers as well form an important part of kind of the market in terms of, you know, someone's out there trying to find fraudulent companies, and, you know, sure, they have a financial incentive behind them, but don't we all when it comes to the stock market?
Yeah, yeah. But the only thing, though, and just on that, is that when you or I speak about a stock, you know, we're acting with integrity, where we don't decide we're recommending a stock. We find a business that looks like it's positioned for greatness, and we then recommend it. And we just don't know if in these short selling houses, is there, like, have they pre-decided which one it looks like it's run too far, too fast, and let's bring this one down to earth a bit. But I totally get your, you just don't know.
And there's always that kind of immediate drop from a short seller as well that people could have bought puts on or something. So yeah, look, it's a shady industry, but I think there's both good actors and bad actors out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. And I'm going to guess that there's going to be a lot more to come out about this story, so stay tuned to future episodes. Probably the other biggest news of the past 2 weeks was the announcement earlier this week that Oracle has beaten out the likes of Microsoft and Twitter in the race to nab TikTok's US operations. This has been a long-running saga, but the deal, which was finally announced on Sunday night, will see Oracle become TikTok's technology partner, reportedly leaving ByteDance, the owner of TikTok, with a majority stake in the business still. It also appears that TikTok's global business will become a company based in the US that will still remain a unit of ByteDance. Rory, I'll come to you first. Does this make sense to you, Oracle becoming a partner of TikTok like this?
Whatever about it making sense, I think what's been exposed over the last week is that this was not in any way a mergers and acquisitions deal. It was not in any way a national security issue. This is political theater being performed right in front of our eyes. You know, it was, you know, noticeable that in July, ByteDance seemed very happy to sell their US operations to Microsoft. That was all kind of going ahead, and we all thought that deal was done and dusted. Then the US administration got involved. They didn't want a minority shareholder in ByteDance, so they were basically cutting ByteDance out of all the upside of the company. And they wanted this kind of sweetheart kicker that was going to go to the US Treasury, which Microsoft, and shame on them, actually said they would do. So and look, when that happens, you've got to think of it this from the Chinese government's point of view. They were not going to allow this to happen. That's when they stepped in and said, hold on a second, no, that's not happening. You're not going to bully us into selling one of our most valuable companies and, you know, demand a kicker to the US Treasury. And I believe this is when they started coming out with these new laws regarding what kind of technology can be exported from China. And as one source close to the company said, you can buy the car, but you can't buy the engine. The algorithm at that point was not for sale, which meant Microsoft's deal was totally in ruins. And Oracle stepped in and basically said, okay, we won't buy the company, but, you know, do you want a cloud infrastructure deal that'll kind of somehow make people think that you're no longer a national security threat? And the Trump administration has agreed to this. And we don't know what the terms of the deal are yet. Probably will know them by the time this podcast goes out, but it's as if Oracle is kind of acting as a sort of babysitter. The company remains Chinese, the algorithm remains in China. All the things that we talked about previously that were actually concerning have not been addressed in any way. It seems like it just became a political issue. Was the administration going to ban a massively popular app with 50 million daily active users in the US alone, which is 15% of the population, right before an election? Probably not. This kind of lets them save face a bit, and China's pretty happy. They've basically called the bluff and won in this case, if you ask me.
Yeah, absolutely. Emmett, what were your thoughts on the deal? Were you disappointed Twitter didn't get their bid in the end?
Yeah, it definitely feels like an anticlimax. A marriage with Oracle is just not as much fun to talk about as Microsoft or Twitter. And even, you know, taking a strategic assessment of what TikTok does for each individual business is quite interesting. You know, we three here in the podcast had numerous debates about, you know, what would TikTok do for Twitter? What would TikTok do for Microsoft from a relevancy perspective and from market penetration and all this kind of stuff? And really, as you've rightfully said there, Rory, it feels like it's a political theater at this stage. And apparently President Trump said on Tuesday, which is yesterday, as we're recording on Wednesday, that his administration would make a decision on the pending deal pretty soon, and that he kind of emphasized his respect for Larry Ellison, who I think is like the fifth wealthiest guy in the world. So really, we're down to just stripping out what made TikTok exciting and valuable, which is their algorithm, and it seems that they've kind of reverse engineered in a solution. So really, it feels to me like it is and has been a storm in a teacup.
Absolutely. Worth noting that Larry Ellison is one of the few in Silicon Valley who's a major Trump supporter. Just a side note.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just putting that fact out there. Let's move on then, because I'm sure that's another story we'll be returning to in the not too distant future. As you mentioned, Emmett, we're recording this on Wednesday, and last night Apple had its famed fall, or autumn as we call it over here, event. This year we saw no new iPhone, strangely enough, but what the company did reveal is what people are already calling a Peloton killer. Rory, I can't mention Peloton without coming over to you. Are you worried as a Peloton shareholder?
Well, it's funny that on, was it Monday, I wrote the Stock of the Month report where I talked about Peloton being the Apple of fitness. Yeah. It seems Apple had a problem with that. they want to be the Apple of fitness. Now, look, we've had this discussion on the podcast many times before. Anytime you hear company X has created a company Y killer, that's, to me, is usually a bullish sign. Famous example being Etsy and handmade by Amazon. The reason Apple are getting into the fitness game is because they've looked at Peloton and said, "Wow, that's a great business. We should get into that." And look, I have looked over the Fitness Plus offering. If you ask me, there's a little bit of crossover with Peloton's digital app subscription, the $12.99 a month one, but there is pretty much no crossover between that and Peloton's Connected Fitness, $39 a month. Which, you know, the main functionality of which is integrating with the in-home device, having live classes, and having a network there of like-minded fitness enthusiasts. You know, basically what Fitness Plus is, let's be honest here, is they've taken the myriad of free YouTube workouts that you can get and basically monetize them. You know, as I mentioned, Yoga by Adrian, who is a famous yoga instructor, she has 8.3 million subscribers on her YouTube channel.
Wow. I think it's fair to say she was the real hero of the coronavirus lockdown.
Yeah, this is what they're pre-recorded videos. Now, there's a little integration with the Apple Watch where they link up with the screen, whatever screen you're watching the workout on, and you can see your health metrics. And you know, if you're struggling, they'll give you a little inspirational boost. You know, keep going for 30 seconds, you can do this. But you know, it's nowhere near the functionality that Peloton has with their connected fitness stuff. What I think Apple's event really showcased is that they are moving into this recurring revenue bundle that Scott Galloway calls a rundle. I know you hate that term, James.
But
so they've launched Apple One, which at its most basic gives you Apple Music, Apple TV Plus, 50 gigs of storage, and the new Apple Arcade game for $9 a month for an individual. It's $15 a month for a family, and then for $30 a month, you can top it up with Fitness Plus and their new Apple Plus service. And this is all about, I mean, we know what they're doing here. They are trying to change the narrative. As I wrote the Daily Insight today, since 2015, Apple's revenue has gone up somewhere around 17%. But their stock's gone up about 4x. So the reason that's happened is because they've had massive multiple expansion. Back in 2015, they were trading at around 11 PE. Today, they're trading at 35 PE. And that's because they've moved transactional customers into recurring revenue customers. So now, instead of having people who are buying a one-time device at $1,000, what they want is all the people who have watches, iPhones, iPads, they want them paying $100 a year for fitness, for TV entertainment, for music entertainment, for video games. And that's how you change the narrative on Wall Street. That's how you turn a single purchase story into a recurring revenue story. And that's why their stock price has exploded over the last couple of years.
Absolutely. Emmett, I want to come to you as the CEO of a business that runs on recurring revenue and subscriptions like this. How important or how different is it to get those customers in on a recurring basis?
Yeah, and thank you for that. Well, it is difficult because nobody likes, there's a greater sense of inertia and reluctance when you know you're clicking on something that's going to pull 5, 10, 20 bucks out of your account every month. And certainly, as you rightfully said, as the CEO of a business in that space, it's the businesses that do it without tapping you on the shoulder to tell you they're doing it. So what I mean by that is if you subscribe to an app that has a monthly charge, you will get an email from Apple every month to say, tomorrow we're taking 10 bucks. Whereas if you go to Netflix or if you go to Audible, you sign up online using their architecture and their terms and conditions, and they simply take the 10 bucks or 15 bucks or whatever it is per month. And those two different models, as subtle as it is, make a world of difference in how long people stay around, because they're not getting 12 reminders a year that they're being charged for something. But from a valuation perspective, like software as a service, as we all know, and as we've kind of focused on over the last, I suppose, 5+ years on my Wall Street, is an incredibly prosperous area for us to fish as stock investors, because it creates a business with predictable revenue lines and ones that you can extrapolate into the future and then start to add on other potential products that possibly have a higher price point. So you can see why Scott Galloway, you can see why Tim Cook, you can see why the world, whether it's Peloton or whether it's Mirror by Lululemon or whether whatever it is, they all want to get a little bit every month as opposed to a lot up front. Now, of course, the razor and blade model is very exciting. Peloton, a lot up front plus a little every month thereafter. So, Rory, I'm not saying anything against Peloton.
Well, speaking of companies that might not have been too happy with Apple's announcement, another company that came to mind is Spotify, who I believe already complained about Apple's new One service, which bundles Apple Music plus a load more services in together for a price that's not that much more than Spotify charges for just its streaming service. Rory, do you think Spotify are right to be worried about this?
Oh, yeah, well, sure. We've had this conversation plenty of times before. This is a massive company with monopolistic powers basically pressing down on the little guy, and Spotify are right to be concerned, and they're right to be angry about it, because this is going to be a challenge for them going forward. I maintain that Spotify is a better product than Apple Music. I think they've got a loyal user base, so we'll see how much price comes into play when people are thinking about switching over. The Apple TV Plus, I still don't think is that exciting a product. I don't know. We'll have to see how they build it out over the years. But like, you know, as Amazon did with Prime, they're going to continually add incremental value to this bundle, and that's when Spotify, and you know, possibly Netflix and possibly other companies need to start getting worried.
I think you made the analogy once. Well, maybe you didn't make it. You robbed the analogy once of Amazon, and they're like a company with a massive air tank that can go underwater for longer than other companies. And I think that's kind of applicable here.
Yeah, no, I did steal that from Scott Galloway.
Maybe he stole it from you. I think you need to. Let's still have
that. He's probably not listening to this, so just take it. It's fine.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's move on and take a look at some other things going on in My Wall Street at the moment. So earlier this week, as Rory mentioned, we published the latest edition of the Stock of the Month podcast. This is an exclusive podcast that you can only find in the My Wall Street app, where Rory and I discuss our latest Stock of the Month pick and get into more detail on the reasons why we believe it's a great investment. I was going to kind of do a big teaser and say this month's pick was a favorite of Rory's, but I think Rory's probably given it away already. But seeing as they've had a quarterly report in the meantime, you should get in and listen to that and hear what Rory thought of Peloton's recent quarterly report. Emmett, you're also hosting a live webinar next week that you want to mention.
Yeah, that's right. Next Wednesday at 5 p.m. Dublin time, which is midday in New York time and 9 a.m. California time, I'm holding a workshop called The Number One Way to Measure and Improve Your Success as an Investor. And in that workshop, I'm just going to, I guess, put a spotlight on something that really changes your overall returns when you've mastered it. And, you know, it's really harnessing one of Einstein's secret obsessions, which he had on doubling his money and how to double it again faster. So what I'll be talking about next Wednesday at midday New York time is, I guess, the only metric you need to measure your portfolio's performance with. And the only metric that certainly from kind of checking your own performance that you really need to know. And at the end of the the show or of the seminar, I'll be sending out the spreadsheet that I use and have used for very many years in order for people to plug in their own numbers and see how they're actually doing.
Sounds good. So I'll include the registration link for that free webinar in the notes for today's show.
It's mywallstreet.com/workshop. mywallstreet.com/workshop.
There you go. Make sure to sign up for it. Let's move on to Jargon Busters. And Emmett, I'm going to come to you again. The first question we have is about SPACs or SPACs. This week, we heard news that the real estate company Opendoor is set to go public via a SPAC. Can you explain to us what exactly a SPAC is and how they work, I suppose?
Sure, yeah. So as many of our listeners know, an alternative to an IPO is a direct listing. And we've spoken about that in the past. And it's how Spotify and I think Slack listed. A third way to get listed on the stock market is a special purpose acquisition company, or SPAC for short. And it is an alternative to traditional IPOs as a way for a company to get onto the stock market. And these SPACs are also known as blank check companies. So there have been a number of high profile companies that have gone to market with a SPAC, which I'll explain in a moment. So companies like DraftKings, Virgin Galactic, Nikola, and now, as you mentioned, James Opendoor have all used SPACs to enter life on the public markets. So here's how they work. A sponsor, who's usually a name and prosperous individual from the world of business, creates a shell company, which he or she uses to raise money from investors. That company floats, the SPAC floats, and then it goes and finds and merges with another privately held operating company, following which shareholders in the SPAC become shareholders in the previously private company, and now it is listed. So what it really allows the owners of business, privately held businesses, to do is list really quickly, get a cash injection, and not have to go through what is a huge amount of work in order to list your business. And now, if you know Chris Kindle, you know, if Christmas is your thing and you do gift exchange in December with your folks, a good SPAC is like, if you invest in a good SPAC, it's a little like being in a Chris Kindle with people with good taste. So like, you know, no matter what you're going to get, it's okay. So like one SPAC we invested in the Horizon service, which I run for my Wall Street, was Chamath Palihapitiya's Social Capital Hedo Sophia 2, which is a mouthful, but it's also known as IPO-B. And IPO-B, well, previously IPO-A became Virgin Galactic, which we were invested in. IPO-B, it was announced yesterday, is becoming Opendoor, which is a story unto itself. So in 2020, and by the way, that picks up 50%. In 2020, plug. In 2020, more than 50 SPACs have been formed in the US. And at the beginning of August, so I'm working on slightly other data, about $22 billion has been raised with SPACs. And about a month ago, Bill Ackman, who, as we know, is the founder of Pershing Square Capital, sponsored his own SPAC and raised $4 billion. Making it the largest ever SPAC. And I think he marched on into Brian Chesky and Joe Gebbia, the founders of Airbnb, and said, hey, do you want to use this? And I think that didn't work out as Bill Ackman would have wished. So I think Airbnb will do it on their own. So SPACs are the third way, if you like, to float your company on the stock exchange. And I think they're the way with the minimal amount of drama for the management team and the business that's about to go onto market.
Emmett, you've come up with a lot of analogies in your time, but I think that Chris Kindle one is definitely my favourite so far. Thanks very much for that. Let's move on to the next question. I'm going to throw this to both of you. Rory, you can go first. So this is a question about traditional valuation metrics for modern companies. You know, when we look at companies, especially high growth companies that might not be profitable at the moment, can we use traditional valuation metrics to analyse those?
Yeah, I mean, that would be very hard to try and extrapolate what people were using back in Benjamin Graham's day to the kind of companies we see at the moment. You know, I think it was Warren Buffett once used the analogy of if you had a steel company, let's say a steel company in Detroit, and you wanted to expand your operations to China, you know, that's, you're talking about a huge operation to ship steel over there, establish distribution, maybe establish a factory. You know, it's not an easy thing to do. If Facebook wants to start operations, China is probably not a good example, but if Facebook wants to start operations in Russia, for example, they literally push a button. Like, that's it. There's no, and so you do see these companies, you know, increasingly we see news reports of company X being the fastest company to ever hit 100 billion in market cap, or to hit revenue of 5 billion. These stories are popping up all the time because companies are growing much faster, because there is just easier ways. The internet has enabled us to provide products to people much faster, much more efficiently. And you're seeing companies today which had margins that were unthinkable back in the days of Graham and Dodd. And so, yeah, it's, you know, there are obviously crossovers. The principles of valuation still remain intact, but you really do need to kind of stretch out your imagination. You know, you can't be looking at a company today as you would look at a company 70 years ago, even if they're in the exact same industry. You know, even if we're talking about a steel company today, you couldn't possibly value them the same way you'd value a steel company 70 years ago. It's just, there's too much has changed in the world, and therefore you do need to update the numbers that you're looking at, the numbers or the ranges that you're going to expect from a traditional valuation metric. Valuation metrics are great tools, but of course they don't tell you the full story. The full story takes a lot more work than that. You know, you can't just invest based on ratios.
What about you, Emmett? I know you have a big doorstop of a book called Traditional Valuation Metrics.
Yeah, actually, I have here on my desk, as you can see, and we're on Zoom here, I have Stocks for the Long Run by Jeremy Segal, fifth edition, of course, the very discerning person's choice. But this is a great book to sit on your bookshelf and gather dust and occasionally prop up your laptop. But it's a good book too to open. But in chapter 11 of fifth edition, folks, on Stocks for the Long Run by Jeremy Segal, there's all the different ways you can go about valuing the overall market and companies. Specifically, he talks about P ratio, earnings yield, you know, CAPE ratio for the overall market, you know, aggregation bias and the Fed model, earnings yield model, bond yields, corporate profit model, GDP, discount models, book values, everything. And there's a nice short, snappy explanation of all the different ways you can go about valuing a business. And it kind of, when I was looking through it, it brought me back to a summer job I had in 1995 where for the first time in my life I saw Microsoft Excel. I mean, I'd been in college for 3 years at this stage, and I went into a bank, and believe me, I cannot tell you how mind-numbingly bored I was. And there was this thing called Microsoft Excel. I couldn't believe that this machine, this mechanical discounted cash flow calculator, that I built up this DCF calculator with Microsoft Excel, and I took printouts of all the different businesses that I kind of experimented or tried to extrapolate their value, their true intrinsic value, with this spreadsheet. And they all had the uniform kind of, they all had the same common kind of attribute of being massively wrong about 3 years later, because I did keep a check to see if they were right. And what I would say about traditional valuation is that the ways in which all these different academics and genuine investment geniuses have come up with valuation techniques, I wouldn't say they become less relevant, but they become harder to get right. And I do think, and I agree with Rory's point, like, it's worthwhile and useful to get your head around valuation. Where could this go? But in in my Wall Street and in some of the greatest stock investment services in the world, and David Gardner of the Motley Fool springs to mind, who I think is probably the greatest living stock picker. Rarely have I seen a price target come into, actually never have I seen a price target come into his conversation. We don't use it in our conversation here. What we simply do is find market beating businesses who have barriers to entry, and we take a strategic look at these businesses and assess the competitive marketplace and how big is the market and can they feasibly address that market. And then the value, the price that is reflected ultimately in a share price, it will come eventually if you're right. But certainly my long-winded way and my long-winded response is I don't do a whole lot of it, but I acknowledge its importance and I have studied it and done it for very many years, and I spent a whole year doing it when I did masters in finance. But frankly, I learned it and disposed of it afterwards.
Okay, cool. Thanks for that. The last question we have here, and we might just touch on this quickly as we're running out of time, is a question about the dangers of stretching your portfolio too thin. So, Emmett, what I think they meant here is, you know, when you're trying to build up to a diversified portfolio of at least 12 stocks and you see these new companies coming all the time that excite you, what kind of strategy should you take in you know, building out your portfolio and ensuring that you're not spreading your capital too thin?
Yeah, well, I think it's a two-factor equation. It's a function of where you are in your life. So there are two variables, I think, when you're designing your portfolio, which is, number one, approximately how much money am I going to put into each stock? And number two, how many stocks am I going to own? And those two variables change as you get older. So your disposable income will change, hopefully for the better, as you get older. And therefore, a full position might move from what starts out to be $100 or $200 to $2,000 or $20,000 or $1,000,000. And that is, in your mind, that's a notional number. Nobody's there to say you're right or wrong. But I think as an investor, you need to first get a grapple on what is the amount of money that feels like a full position for me, which is a chunky amount of change in my life. And then how many of these do I want to have? Now, stretching yourself or your portfolio too thin is a very personal consideration. And some of the greatest investors the world has ever seen, like Peter Lynch, had thousands of stocks in the Fidelity Magellan fund. Yeah. Some others are hyper concentrated with 12. And we at My Wall Street say you should aim for 12. There's 12 months in a year. You can spend a year building a portfolio and then you are properly diversified. But really, for me, and this is my personal answer, the correct number of stocks for me in a portfolio where I can keep, my understanding of all the businesses in a nice contained ball is around 22 stocks. And you know what? For some people, it'll be 30s. For some people, it'll be 50. But really, stretching yourself too thin is a personal question. And it comes down to how much money will I put per share and how many of these am I going to buy? And we think a nice rule of thumb for heaven is, yeah, aim for 12 and then see how it goes.
Okay, cool. Thanks very much for that. Let's move on to the elevator pitch. So as we've kind of talked about already, the second half of this year looks set to be packed full of IPOs, including some huge names like Airbnb, Palantir, Snowflake, and plenty more. So my elevator pitch for you guys today is, which IPO are you most excited about seeing in the second half of this year? Rory, I'll come over to you first. What IPO are you looking forward to seeing?
Well, this is one that I was very excited about, but it turns out that, like, it appears absolute mania has taken hold, and before it's even gone out, the initial price has basically doubled over the last couple of days. And that company, I'm sure people already know who I'm talking about, is Snowflake. So, when I first laid eye on this company, I'm not that au fait with the whole tech stack thing, but I did a bit of research chatting to people who do know this stuff and was basically told these guys are the bee's knees. This is the company you want to work with. This is the company you want to own in the space in terms of tech infrastructure. And then you look at the numbers, you can see why investors are excited. They've got 121% year-on-year revenue growth, 158% net retention. You've got 56 companies paying over $1 million a year. And, you know, it's the numbers are fantastic. The business looks tip top, but I have no idea what it's going to end up at on its IPO. I think it's going to probably be at an outrageous price that we wouldn't be able to justify. But
you were blaming Warren Buffett for that, weren't you?
Yeah, well, he just back off sometimes, you know.
Leave us alone.
Let some of the rest of us get in on the ground floor, buddy.
He's so rich.
Well, you just, anytime Warren Buffett gets involved in a business, it's just like everyone has to get involved in it.
It's a pretty big buy signal.
Absolutely. It's great when you own a business and he gets involved afterwards, but when he does it before you, you're like, ugh.
But now he's getting them when they're still private, which is pretty annoying. Emmett, what company are you looking forward to seeing IPO?
Yeah, well, I am very much looking forward to seeing Snowflake for all the reasons that Rory outlined, but I'm going to go with Airbnb. A business I think everyone knows. I'd say all our listeners know it. I've stayed in about 20 Airbnbs. Apparently, there are around 6 million hosts and experiences available on the platform. They have pretty much smashed into 160 plus countries. They are a business that I admire greatly and know quite well, as do most of our listeners. And I think the Airbnb flotation is one that's... is different to most of the others we'll see this year because it's a truly known global brand. And I think in its last funding round, which was an internal down round around April of this year, they were valued at was around $26 billion. And previously they were around $31 billion. So what in fact market cap they'll have on IPO day remains to be seen. I'd hazard a guess something between $40 and $60 billion. I mean, Uber's, I don't know, it's probably around $70 billion, $80 billion at the moment. And I don't like, and I shouldn't have even used Uber in the same sentence as Airbnb because they are so entirely, completely and utterly different. But I guess in the sharing economy, a lot of people draw on that. But I think that Airbnb is today in the year 2020 analogous to, Coca-Cola when it floated 101 years ago. That it basically was category creating, category defining, already a global brand. And I think that people who buy shares in Airbnb at this, in this stage, in 101 years, will be really happy they did so.
Maybe their children or grandchildren might be happy.
Yeah.
That's it from today's Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in the My Wall Street app in the moment, including that Stock of the Month podcast about Peloton. If there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode of Stock Club, make sure to get in touch. You can find us, as always, on Twitter. That's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club, and if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review or a rating for us on whatever platform you listen to us on. That will really help us out. From all of us here, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing. This episode of Stock Club is brought to you by Hyundai. Restart your journey towards a greener world with Hyundai's next generation of zero-emission cars. Find out more about their range of electric vehicles and the savings they can bring to your company and employees at Hyundai.ie.